Good afternoon. So, last time we talked a bit about information leaks, then about kind of overwriting pointers via overflows, like overflows on the stack, where instead of overwriting a return address, we'd overwrite some pointer that was stored on the stack, and how this would often give us what I called a write gadget, that this would, you know, the pointer would be used to write to some memory, and by overwriting it, we change what memory was written to, and often, because of the context of the code, the value written to that memory would also be something we'd have some control over. And this, you know, kind of gets a little confusing because we have multiple kind of levels of indirection that we're not, like with our stack smashing attack, directly overwriting our return address. If we want to do that same kind of attack with this technique, we need to first place a pointer to the return address by overwriting an existing pointer, and then there's an extra step that needs to happen where the code uses that pointer to overwrite our return address. And we talked about, well, return addresses is a thing we could overwrite this way, but often that wouldn't be the easiest thing to do. So one example of something that might be more convenient to overwrite would be global offset table entries. We learn that these are when we have libraries. This is how we call libraries. This is filled in when we load the library, and sometimes kind of as needed. And if we overwrite this now, you know, when some function, library function is called, it instead calls some location of our choice. And then we talked about another kind of function pointer that we might be able to overwrite. And this is vtables. And this is kind of the classic way of implementing polymorphism for compiled languages. So we have a method that is supposed to be called based on the actual type of an object. How do we look up where the real version of that method is? And it's going to be different depending what the type of the object is. If we have, you know, a shape pointer, but it actually might be a circle or rectangle, like we have to find the correct version of that method. A common way of doing this is to have a table of function pointers for each potential class it could be, and have a pointer to that table at the beginning of the object in every version of, in the example I just gave, the shape class. Every subclass would start with this pointer to the list of methods. And we call that list of methods, that table, a vtable. And because this pointer to that table is kind of in the middle of our objects, and our objects are writable, this is something that's going to be vulnerable to our buffer overflows and other memory attacks we'll talk about later in the semester. And so often, kind of the most practical way for an attacker to get control over what code gets executed. So questions? Things we covered last time. Yes? I talk about question two on the quiz. I honestly have not looked at how people were doing on the quiz. So let's go through that. So, quiz question two. Where is my mouse? My mouse is on the wrong side, just to confuse me. The byte of the input. So we want to overwrite. I hope I didn't key this wrong. If I did, I will correct that. So the question here is, we want to overwrite the return address when read number or minus one is called. So the question is, where is the return address relative to the beginning of the input that's being read? And my cursor on this side. And so if we look at read number or minus one, did I do math wrong? Yeah, so if we look at read number or minus one, the return address is going to be, I'll copy this over. Here, so we have, I'll have push VX sub 32 RSP, and the call to get us is LEA 12 RSP to X, and then we have a move RBX to RDI, and then a call get us. So I have this here. So this is the relevant assembly snippet from read number. And if we think about what our stack looks like, initially our stack pointer points to the actual return address, and then we push RBX, and then our stack pointer points below that. And then we, so this is going to be 8 bytes. Then we subtract 32. This is 32 bytes. And then we add 12 to that. So this here is 12. And this is our buffer. So this is 20 bytes. This is 8 bytes. And then there's our return address. Question, yes?
Would it be acceptable to say that it's the 29th byte? Because if you start counting from 1.
Oh, would it be acceptable to say 29th byte? Yes. I will accept that answer. Yeah, that's not, wasn't the point of the question. Okay. Was it 0 or 1 indexed? Sorry, yeah, I should have been explicit about that in question. Okay, yeah, I will deal with that. And that might be the main reason people have trouble, not the, though I suspect the other second most common reason people have trouble is missing this RBX needing to be accounted for. Yeah?
I had another question about the question 4.
Okay.
And I was wondering, what does the int 3 instruction do?
What does the int 3 instruction do? Oh.
When the program is executed outside of the debugger.
It tells the OS that the program requested a debugger run, which usually is not going to work out to the program running normally.
Okay. So it would interrupt the program execution?
Yeah, so usually the default action for that is crashing the program.
Okay. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. And you could have observed this by trying it. I think if you try, I don't know of any system where if you try to run in 3 outside of the debugger, the program won't crash. Yeah.
One more question, quick question. For question 3, answer E. Can you explain why temp 100 would not be off the stack frame? It seems like, or my thinking for this one was that, if you go beyond the return address.
So the question is, wouldn't temp 100 be off the stack frame? Yes. Does that mean it's invalid memory? Depends how much stuff was called before this. So as long as there were sufficient functions before the beginning of the stack, that temp 100 is a valid memory location, we can put stuff there. And yes, we're corrupting some other stack frame, but we probably never intend to go back to that stack frame anyways, because our shell code's just going to take over the whole program. Does that answer your question?
Yes, although I did say false because I thought that what you were asking is always a valid value, right? And so
we should give credit in comment grading by the TAs for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I just had the same question.
Yeah, so my intention was this would be not unconditionally possible, but, okay. you know, possible in non-obscure circumstances, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was just doing it based on the assembly provided.
Yeah, so I think the thing that would break the at temp 100 is just, is there still valid memory that far up? Which, you're correct, we can't tell for sure, but, yeah. But it's pretty common for that to be the case. If you think of, like, you know, if we have a main, is a main really using less than, this would be like 60 bytes on the stack for us to not be able to put something there. But yes, I agree. Maybe I should have been more explicit about what I meant by possible, but I meant like would be consistent, but yeah, I should have been clearer about, you know, subject to other things in the code not disrupting it. Other questions? Yeah.
For option B, like, it wouldn't make sense to do that, but would it work?
Question, would it make sense to do that, would it work? The problem with option B is that we have no way of overflowing to there.
No way to what?
We have no way to place shellcode there. It would run that, and then it would go back to where string2l returns?
Yeah.
Which would be a loop.
It wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't crash.
Yeah, I think I would say that's not a stack smashing attack if we're doing that. Yeah. Your question, or?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, for number C, we only have like 8 bytes of room to work with if we're not going to execute the return address.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. So that's true. We only have 8 bytes to work with. So there's a couple ways we could deal with that. So if our shellcode is like, so it's possible we can fit our shellcode in 8 bytes for some things we might want to do. If not, we can like jump over the return address in our shellcode or something like that. So have the shellcode start there, or jump backwards. You know, that would just be the entry point of the shellcode. It doesn't mean all the shellcode has to be, you know, contiguous off there, just because, like, when you're in assembly, it doesn't have to keep running. You can have jumps and things like that. And yeah, it's possible we could, you know, in some cases, we could fit our shellcode in 8 bytes. So for example, maybe our shellcode is move something into RDI, jump to a function. We can fit that in 8 bytes. Other questions? Okay, so I will deal with the 29 issue. Yes, I should have been explicit about I meant 0 or 1 based. That is not what I meant to get credit off for. Okay, so we were talking about vtables. And we mentioned that there's kind of these kind of three options when we're attacking function pointer tables. And kind of the most obvious option is, well, with the return address, we just overwrote that pointer. And we might think, okay, let's overwrite the vtable pointer. The pointer in the vtable, I should say. So the actual address of the function to call. Usually that won't be possible because it will be in read-only memory. It's probably a reasonable question to ask, why wouldn't this also be true for the global offset table? And sometimes it is true for the global offset table. And we'll talk about that probably later this week, possibly with Brad Campbell. But the short answer is, we talked about lazy binding for dynamic linking, where we'd figure out what to put in a global offset table entry as the program runs. But for vtable entries, we don't really need to do that. So it's much more common for vtable entries themselves to not be writable. But that really isn't a problem, because we can do the second option where we basically make up a subclass. And if we had a subclass, it would have a vtable. So we have a buffer that contains a vtable, which is not a real vtable, but one we made up. We just have an array with pointers to the functions to call for this object. And those functions are our shellcode. You know, the foo method of this object runs our shellcode. The bar method also runs our shellcode. How about that? And this will give us control, and in that case, we're not overwriting the actual vtable entries, we're overwriting the pointer to the vtable, which is in the object itself. We know the object is writable, so probably its vtable is writable, since, as we'll learn when we talk about making memory read-only, or as you might already know if you took CSO2, we can't really make memory writable or not writable at a very fine granularity. The other thing we could potentially do, which is if we can't like write out a vtable somewhere and point to it, maybe we can find some array that already exists in the program that does something useful to us. So probably the most common example of this is you can point to the wrong vtable of some other object and have it execute some other object's method. And whether this is useful or not depends on the program, but you might imagine like if we have an object that like executes shell commands, that might be a really nice method to point to and say, yes, the draw method of the shape is this execute shell command method of this other completely unrelated object. So that might be an option there. So let's look at option two. Let's go through how would we set this up. So here I have an object which has a buffer we can overflow. And I have an array of those objects. So the idea is when we overflow this buffer, at buffer 100, the end of the buffer, is the vtable pointer for the next object in the array. And our assumption in this example here is that we're going to have some overflow when we're inputting into the buffer for element 0 of the array. That's going to let us modify the vtable pointer for element 1 of the array. And sometime later, that vtable pointer is going to be used to call the foo method on element 1 of the array. And I've written out that the way that would happen is we get a pointer to element 1 and call it via pointer. Why did I say that instead of we call it directly in element 1? Because with a pointer, presumably the compiler doesn't know it's actually vulnerable class versus a subclass of vulnerable class. If the compiler knew it was definitely a vulnerable class object, it wouldn't look to a vtable lookup, potentially. Because it knows, oh, it can't be another, the method has to be the vulnerable class, one, not a subclass. But with a pointer, it wouldn't know that. So my question is, what do we place in our buffer? And I have three locations, so come up with a plan you think will work, or if you think you need some other locations to specify, you can do that. Check with your neighbors, but how should we try to exploit this? What input will cause our shellcode to be run when that pointer arrow foo calls the foo method on objects of one? You can check with your neighbors, see if you agree. What we should set up. And I should make these options actually distinct. I meant for E, the address of the B table pointer or something. Because otherwise it's the same as D. Who'd like some more time? A bunch of people? Okay. Sorry. If you're looking for, stuck for like an approach, like the thing I would try to remember is like, what's the procedure how pointer arrow foo is going to be executed? And what's going to happen there is that when this gets executed, we're going to pointer points here. We're going to look at whatever's here. We're going to follow that and expect to find the address of foo here, and we're going to jump to wherever that points to. And with the initial setup, the way that would work is this pointer would point to this slot here, which is already filled in with the address of the real foo. So we want to somehow use that process will happen and set it up so it goes to our shell code.
We're on something here.
Okay. Who can give me a starting point, something I should, that would be useful? Yes.
Maybe at input start, you could put the address of object 0.buffer50.
Okay, so at start, you want to put the address of object 0.buffer50, so C. And what's the purpose in doing that?
So that way we can put, or can I just explain the whole thing?
You could just start with what. Why did we choose C here?
The idea is that we can jump to that later.
What do you mean by jump to that?
Like that address will be jumped to.
Will be jumped to. So the you mean? So the address. Okay. So the address, meaning buffer 50, will be jumped to, based on here.
Right.
Okay. So what we're. So I think what you're proposing is that we have. Is that we're going to pretend the beginning of our buffer is a vtable. So we're going to have this be a sort of a fake vtable. And it has the same layout as our real vtable, meaning that the first entry in it is going to be the slot for foo, and the second entry is going to be the slot for bar. We don't actually care what's in the slot for bar, because as far as we hopefully it never gets run. If it does, we have to fill it in. And we're going to fill in C as the slot for foo. Meaning that foo, that in our buffer halfway through here, this is going to be our fake foo. It's going to be there, right in the middle of the buffer. And if that's our fake foo, that's going to be where we're going to put our shellcode. Because when pointer foo calls its foo, it's going to find, hope if we set this up correctly, that our shellcode is actually the foo method of objects of one. Now, to make that happen, we need to change the vtable pointer to, instead of pointing to the normal place, the real vtable, it needs to point to our fake vtable. So to make that happen, we're going to put the address of our fake vtable to overwrite the pointer to the real vtable. So this is kind of the fake vtable contents is what's our startover input in this design. Then we have our fake foo method. And then we have our pointer to the fake vtable. So we set up this kind of false vtable, pretending basically that objects of one is not a vulnerable class, it's a subclass of a vulnerable class whose foo method is our shellcode. Questions about this setup? Yes?
Sorry. Could you just go through one more time, like what points to what within the object array?
What points to what? So when we set this attack up, I'll do a zoom in on our buffer to make this clearer. I'll do a zoom in on our buffer over here. We're going to have, at the beginning of our buffer in this design, we're going to have slot for foo and slot for bar, because this is going to be as a vtable, interpret it as a vtable, we're going to do that, cause the code to do that, and we're filling in slot to foo to point to our shellcode. Here. Now, we also need to modify the objects of two, and that's, it's here. So this is the objects of one, sorry, dot vtable, and we want to make this point to our thing we want interpreted as a vtable. Does that answer your question? I note that we could also have done this by swapping the location of the vtable in the shellcode and get a similar answer. That's also the point. Yes?
What's the difference between
What's the difference between C and B? Oh, C is the fake, yep, that's consistent. It's the fake foo address. Yeah. Or, I guess, sorry, not fake foo, that's the fake foo, code is item two, but B is pointer to the fake vtable, right? So we have our fake vtable, which has a pointer to our shellcode, and our pointer to that, because if we remember, the way the method call works is it's doubly indirect. So we have to have two pointers to handle that. Other questions? Okay, so wanted to go through this. This pattern will come up even when we're not doing these sort of standard buffer overflows, because this is kind of one of the most, making vtables have invalid values is kind of one of the most common ways memory attacks of all sorts are actually executed on real programs. And this includes some types of memory attacks we haven't talked about, like use after free vulnerabilities. This idea of making the vtable pointer point to the wrong place is kind of the key way that those attacks work too. So we're going to see this again later in the semester with a very different kind of memory bug. So we were looking at, we have a way of overwriting vtables and pointers. The other thing which occurs with our idea of we have some pointer we overwrite, what are we going to do with that, is that we can often kind of chain these vulnerabilities together. We get one overwrite that lets us overwrite a pointer. We can often, depending on the context, have that turn into something which lets us get a whole lot more control and set up a lot more for some attack. So for example, in this scenario here, I manipulate one pointer through a buffer overflow. In this case, when I input my name, the program doesn't check the bounds, and I overwrite this pointer to struct B. And I can make that point to anywhere in memory, and the next statement is going to write to that location in memory a whole lot of stuff. So often we can end up chaining these things together to to start with some small overflow vulnerability and turn that into something that lets us set up kind of an arbitrary amount of stuff in the program. Stuff that might seem hard otherwise, I have one overflow. Is everything actually in the A object for me to exploit that? Well, it doesn't need to be, because I can choose a second location, and very often, if we have to think of a server, it might send multiple commands. We might be able to choose an arbitrary list of locations and just set up everything we need for our attack, even if that involves modifying a whole bunch of memory locations. Okay, so talked about a bunch of overwrites, and so far it's kind of seemed the way we're going to take advantage of that is that we're going to send the overwrite to code we've written, and we're going to send it direct to our code. There are some alternatives to that, and I'm going to start by looking at a case where the reason we're going to talk about that alternative is that alternative is easier than writing the shellcode. We're going to learn later, after we talk a bit about kind of modern memory protection, that there's this kind of mechanism where modern systems make it hard to write data and then execute it. And so we'll also need these kind of techniques to work around that problem. And we're going to have a more sophisticated version of what I'm going to show you next that's going to let us do kind of the equivalent of shellcode, but without actually writing machine code. But for now, we're not going to do something that's like shellcode. We're going to do something that's simpler than shellcode. And kind of our key insight for all these techniques is that we're going to replace the return address for our function rather than with the address of our shellcode. We're going to find something in the program that's useful to run. And you might say, well, that seems like you have to get real lucky, doesn't it? The answer is you don't. That every program almost always accidentally has code that's useful to run. And we're going to talk about like the more sophisticated version of this called return-oriented programming or jump-oriented programming. But I'm going to start with the simple reason why almost every program has something that's useful for you to run. And my simple justification is here's a nice, interesting function that's in the C standard library. And pretty much every program has the C standard library loaded in its memory. So this function exists somewhere in that memory. And what does this function do? It takes an argument and runs that command. Now you might say, wait a moment, you know, when we're returning, we're just jumping somewhere, we're not setting arguments, but the argument is whatever value's in RDI when this function runs. And what's going to be in RDI? Well, probably some value is going to be left over there. And often we'll get lucky, and the value will be like our input string, because, well, the program has to put the input string in some register, and sometimes that register will be RDI. Or if it's not our input string, it will be some other thing that's based on our input. Just because, you know, the assembly typically doesn't, like, you don't reset RDI before you return, generally. That's, like, would be a wasteful thing for the compiler to do, so it usually won't. So if we find a buffer overflow where RDI happens to have a value we can control, we just don't write shellcode, we just direct it to system. Already exists, just need to find out where it is in memory. And do. So how can we know that? So we can look up where that runs. So this is with address randomization and it's disabled. We're going to talk about address randomization next, and address randomization is one reason why, you know, one thing, reason it exists is to make this kind of thing harder to do. Kind of our defense, or the way we're going to execute this attack if there's address randomization is we're going to need an information leak like we needed for the stack canary. And we'll talk about that when we talk about address randomization more explicitly. But without address randomization, I figure out for binls, with just as my example program, that, oh, it's going to load libc at this address. And in libc, 55410 hex bytes in is where the system function is implemented. So the address I want to overflow the return address with is this one. Questions? Yes. So this idea goes by various names. I wrote return to somewhere. So the names you'll see in various literature is sometimes you'll often see return to libc, because most commonly people are returning to a function in libc, even though you don't have to do that. You could find some function in the program, for example. Another name you'll sometimes hear is arc injection. But the idea is just that rather than, we don't write shellcode, we just find a useful function. And as I mentioned, the preview of the future is that there's going to be a more sophisticated version of this where we'll have a solution to what if RDI isn't set right? We can fix that almost all the time. Not all the time, but almost all the time. And so I'll use this to lead into, I'm going to go through an example of a bug that was in NTPD on, I think, OS X, which had this pointer subterfuge pattern. So we mentioned the pattern of we overwrite a pointer and use that to cause more pointer overwrites to happen. And go through kind of the whole process for doing that. And I'm mentioning arc injection before this because the way this is overwritten kind of looks like that arc injection idea. So the vulnerable code in this case is this memmove. So memmove is kind of like memcopy. If you know memcopy, it copies bytes from the source to the destination of the specified length. And basically, this length could be wrong and cause an overflow. It could be bigger than where a data pointer points to. And in particular, we have this pattern where data pointer typically points to a global buffer. And the way the memory was laid out is that after the global buffer was the data pointer. So if we overflow that global buffer, we overwrite the data pointer. And so the attack I'm going to explain takes advantage of this to do kind of two phases. That on our first phase, we use the normal value of the data pointer to rewrite the data pointer, doing a buffer overflow. And then in the next phase, the data pointer points somewhere else, and we run this memmove again. This is a network service we can send multiple requests to. And this time it overwrites a memory location of our choice. So questions on this setup? So we're going to overwrite some memory location. The question is, like, what memory location do we want to overwrite? And the choice made in this attack was that they use a global offset table entry. And they had a particular reason for doing that, which was that in the context of this code, there was a call to string_len afterwards, and the argument to string_len happens to be a string that comes in from the network. And so what the attack is going to do is it's going to modify the global offset table to transform this call into system of the same string by just pointing it to the system function instead of the string_len function. And conveniently, RDI, the argument to system, is going to be set up correctly because that's how calling string_len works. You set the argument to string_len to point to the string. And this meant that they didn't need to deal with writing any shellcode, and more importantly for this attack, that there were mechanisms in place to prevent you from writing code and executing it. Those don't matter when you do this. We aren't writing any machine code and executing it. We're using existing machine code and just pointing to it. So the kind of sequence of this exploit is that first they overwrite data PT with a buffer overflow to point to the string_len global offset table entry. Then they have the server take another request, and this time data pointer no longer points to the right place. It points to that string_len entry, and it runs that again, and it overwrites the string_len global offset table entry to point to the system function. And they chose not the system function in the library itself, but the stub function that calls it. But the effect's the same. And then they make a network request that uses the argument to string_len and runs a command that they find interesting. And I think it happened that the server was running as root, so lots of good choices of commands to demonstrate the attack. So our phases of the attack are, first, we overflow the buffer to overwrite data pointer, so it points to the string_len entry. Then we set things up to use that overwrite to make it point to the system stub function, the system at PLT you'd see in the executable, and then run that. So questions, this example. So the real exploit, there's a blog post that I'm taking this from, but it was more complicated. It needs to defeat some mitigations that we'll talk about later. Most notably, I believe some address randomization was in use, so that was an issue. They couldn't overflow with null characters, so that was a consideration for like values of things. And the bug was not like an easy, there was things about the NTP protocol that were involved in triggering the bug. You know, this wasn't like any network request satisfied, this were there were conditions on it. But this is an example, kind of a real use of that pointer subterfuge pattern. You know, basically turning what, you know, doesn't look like an obviously exploitable bug into an exploitable one, right? The non-obvious exploitables, yeah, you can overflow this buffer, but you're just changing global variables. How are you going to do that and just make the program do something you want it to do rather than just crash or give like wrong numbers? And this is an example of, well, there's a pointer there. Probably we can make it happen. And, you know, in this proof of concept, they demonstrated, yeah, you can do that. So questions? And I guess one lesson I want people to learn kind of in general from this class is that, you know, there aren't safe buffer overflows is kind of the history we have. This is that it looks not exploitable. That doesn't mean it's not exploitable in practice. There's lots of, you know, this is why things like stack canaries are really half measures to defend against this type of thing. Questions? Okay, and I have an exercise here, which I guess we can start. Probably don't have an effect. So here, have an example, have a function here where we have a student object S, and we first do this overflow where we can set the email field, which is going to overflow into the assignments array. And then we have this string copy using the assignments array at index 0. To write a string. So the question is, if I want to use this to set a specific memory location to a specific value, how do I do that? And we can see we can probably do that because that second string copy is based on a pointer we can overwrite. I'll probably review this at the beginning of next time. So basic idea is string 1 is going to go into here. So for string 1, I want it to have 128 characters, and assuming there's no padding in the struct, followed by a pointer to a fake assignment object. And our fake assignment object should be set up such that the location of the regrade request is going to be, this should be equal to 102.030.304.050. This is our regrade request part, and then we have our submission file part. So we want the regrade request part to have that address, which means the address we want to fill in is going to be, if we call this address X, this is going to be X minus 128. And that's what we're going to put as our pointer value. And this kind of offsetting is a frequent thing which happens in these sorts of attacks in practice, is that, you know, we have pointers to objects, objects, you know, have a layout, and we're getting overwriting a specific part. So we actually need to like do a little math on our pointers to achieve the effect we want. So we'll look at this again next time, I'm out of time, and start talking about some mitigations for, you know, mostly mitigations for why is it possible to write code and execute it? Well, it's usually not. We'll talk about why that is and how that works.